Chapter 2. The World's Newest Nation. On June 8, 2020, staff and officers of the Seattle Police Department, SPD, frantically loaded what they could from their East Precinct onto cars and a rented moving truck. The East Precinct is located in the heart of the Capitol Hill neighborhood in Seattle, a densely packed business and residential area popular with artists, leftists, and the city's LGBTQ community. For days, the neighborhood was marred by scenes of intense violence by rioters intent on overtaking the East Precinct, similar to what was done to the Third Precinct in Minneapolis. Night after night, hundreds of Antifa and BLM militants lined the streets, throwing rocks, concrete chunks, and incendiary devices at officers, leading to multiple injuries. By now, police were banned from using tear gas to disperse rioters. A few days prior, Police Chief Carmen Best relented to political pressure from the mayor's office to ban the SPD from using the crowd control tool, despite its effectiveness. Mayor Jenny Durkan, a Democrat and former U.S. attorney in Washington State, appointed by Barack Obama, had given numerous concessions to the far left in the wake of George Floyd's death. A week and a half prior, on May 30, 2020, multiple SPD cruisers were smashed and set on fire by rioters dressed in black bloc. In the chaos, some of the rioters stole weapons, including AR-15s, from the vehicles. There were no police in sight. Harrowing footage recorded at the scene showed a security guard for a local Fox News affiliate charging in with his handgun to disarm one of the militants who stole a rifle. The unnamed Marine Corps veteran did this twice, successfully taking back the stolen rifles from two black bloc militants. Despite the ultra-violence of the Seattle riots, police were prohibited from using the best tool they had for crowd control. CS gas. Also known as tear gas, CS gas is used by law enforcement agencies around the world. As soon as one is exposed to the gas, which is dispersed from canisters, the eyes, nose, throat, and skin experience intense irritation. Through the course of my protest and riot reporting, I have been exposed to it at various times and intensities. I describe the feeling as walking into a plume of pepper. Each breath brings more pain. Fortunately, the extreme discomfort and irritation are temporary. The effects usually clear within about 20 minutes of leaving the area. It is favored by law enforcement because it works extremely well at clearing crowds and has a low chance of actual bodily injury compared to other tools like batons. But the SPD were now banned from using it. Although a federal judge later suspended the ordinance, the directive from the city effectively prohibited its use. The consequences for police were severe. They suffered broken bones, eye injuries, and burns from rocks and IEDs thrown by mobs of rioters. No longer able to push back the nightly onslaught from black-clad rioters in Capitol Hill, and facing pressure from the mayor's office to pull back, Seattle police boarded up and abandoned the East Precinct. Within hours, militant BLM and Antifa protesters declared ownership of most of the neighborhood. They named their new six-block territory the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone, or CHAZ. It was later renamed by some as Capitol Hill Occupied Protest, or CHOP. No laws or rules applied here except for one. No cops allowed. Against all logic and reason, CHAZ was allowed by the city to run its course for more than 3 weeks. It was a large-scale experiment in anarchy, chaos, and brute force criminality. Various Occupy-type protests have occurred across the United States since the original occupation in Manhattan in 2011. But CHAZ is noteworthy for taking control of such a large and densely populated territory. Toward the end of its 24-day run, the There were numerous assaults, robberies, an attempted rape, 6 shootings, and 2 homicides. When the SPD evacuated from the station on June 8, 2020, mass protesters stole city property, barricades, fencing, and more, to create makeshift barriers. These barriers became the official walls around Chaz. A movement that has border abolishment at the core of its ideology immediately set up its own border to keep out outsiders. To fortify their barricades, armed volunteer allies moved in. They operated as a private militia, complete with their own uniforms. "We need more people with guns at the Chaz," tweeted Seattle anti-fascists. It received hundreds of retweets. Many of those who showed up wore patches to signal they were part of the Puget Sound John Brown Gun Club. The far-left militia-type organization is named after radical slavery-era abolitionist John Brown. It is a regional offshoot of the Redneck Revolt, a far-left militia. Conservative investigative media group Project Veritas infiltrated the North Carolina chapter of Redneck Revolt in 2018. An undercover journalist caught the group preparing for revolutionary armed conflict. These groups provide volunteer armed security for Antifa and BLM events. In 2019, a member of the John Brown Gun Club carried out a firebombing attack on an Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, facility in Tacoma, Washington. He was killed by police. Despite the group's link to violent extremism, its armed members were celebrated in the Chaz for protecting the residents. On the first night that police withdrew from Capitol Hill, masked militants harassed and assaulted the press. Brandy Cruz, a reporter with local news station Q13, was accosted and hit with an umbrella. One of the people who surrounded her was Nicholas James Armstrong, a transsexual Antifa militant who uses the pseudonym Nikki Jameson. "I recognize Armstrong immediately because she had threatened me for months online and at one point tried to rally people to my physical location when I was grocery shopping in Portland." Using numerous monikers like @WAblackflag, Armstrong tweets extremist content in support of Antifa. In January 2020, she wrote, "We can't wait till someone gets sick of this guy's Andy No shit and rearranges his face proper. It's inevitable, really, but the anticipation is killing us." In 2019, Armstrong was legally barred from owning dangerous weapons, including guns, in King County, where Seattle is. Despite that, she was one of the armed security at Chaz. "I saw her patrolling the zone with a revolver on her hip. In Portland, I made the decision to go to Chaz. There's a lot of reporting one can do from a distance away, but at some point it requires being on the ground. But I was scared, terrified actually. Ever since I was beat by Antifa in June 2019, one of the debilitating psychological consequences is anxiety in crowds. I had never suffered from anaclophobia, a fear of crowds, but everything changed after the attack. For my own safety, I stopped documenting Antifa riots and gatherings. I hated giving Antifa what they wanted, fear, but they've made it very clear they want to beat me again and this time finish the job. But a friend of mine urged me to go. Chaz was spread out over 6 blocks. This was a large chunk of territory in contrast to the small, densely packed Antifa riot zones in Portland. I thought about it and decided I couldn't live in perpetual terror. I packed up a small suitcase filled with random black block-style clothing and departed for Seattle. When I arrived and made my way past one of the checkpoints, a few of the guards looked at me. My heart sank with each step I took. I knew that if I was interrogated and my cover was blown, I would receive no help from police or anyone else. The source in the SPD had already warned me that they were instructed to stay out of Chaz. I'd asked him, "What if there's an emergency inside?" He replied that the victim would have to come out or be brought out for help. And just as quickly as the guards looked at me, they looked away. I was fully masked up in black block in the summer heat, so they viewed me as one of their own. I walked farther into the fortressed autonomous zone. A sign posted on one of the barriers read, "You are now leaving the USA." In the week I spent undercover at Chaz, I was able to observe the operations that sustained the chaos for weeks. Although I wasn't privy to the innermost details of comrades who'd been vetted as leaders and organizers, I was trusted enough for them to occasionally let their guard down in conversations. In many ways, being at Chaz was like being among jihadists. To each other, they showed a lot of care and camaraderie in the form of mutual aid and compassion, but opponents to their political agenda needed to be destroyed. While there were many kinks in running their so-called autonomous zone, no running water was an issue, what was clear were the dedication and training some of the organizers had for safety. This was most visible in the security apparatus, which was responsible not just for providing armed guard at checkpoints, but also for de-escalating fights and responding to emergencies. In short, they operated a lot like police, but without professional training or accountability. The head of Chaz's security, at least for part of the time, at night, was a short female called Creature. All the security volunteers used monikers when referring to one another. She wore a white helmet to be easily identifiable in crowds. Creature and the rest of her team communicated using walkie-talkie-type devices and earpieces. They were each assigned across various zones within Chaz. Some of them openly carried weapons like rifles, handguns, batons, or knives. When I saw Creature, she was responding to a health crisis of one of Chaz's residents. On a street intersection just outside one of the border checkpoints, an inconsolable, screaming woman sat on the ground. Chaz security wanted to move her so that their vehicle could pass through the road. In fact, these medical crises became quite common at Chaz as vagrants and others flocked to the zone's tent encampment where free food was provided. Another person had allegedly overdosed earlier in the week and was transported to hospital by an ambulance. Before Creature could get a handle on the screaming woman, she received another urgent call on her walkie-talkie. I couldn't hear what was said, but she promptly left the area to rush to another part of Chaz. I tried following her, but she melted into the crowd. At night time, brawls between residents were common. Security often tried to act as mediators, but they were usually unsuccessful. The security team's operating base was in the open-air eating section of the Rancho Bravo Tacos restaurant, where they had set up a large tent. The business seemingly allowed or tolerated Chaz security to set up camp there in exchange for peace. Signs posted all over the base declared, "No photos, no videos." A sign next to it listed Venmo names for cash donations for medical and food supplies. Another sign listed the contact information for the National Lawyers Guild, a far-left legal group that provides pro bono help for militant leftists and Antifa. Though Chaz claimed to have no rules, what quickly developed was a complex code of conduct that varied from area to area within the zone, and even with the time of day. For example, those in the garden area, who were mostly white, needed to make sure they did not recolonize the space. Signs around the gardens reminded people of this. There was even a separate garden for black and indigenous folks, after concerns arose over there being too many whites in the area. The gardens featured residents' attempts at growing herbs and vegetables. Though freshly planted, Most of the plants had wilted within a day or two. On the outside, reports from legacy media outlets focused heavily on the alleged block party atmosphere of the occupation, repeating a talking point from Mayor Durkan. The Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone, hashtag Chaz, is not a lawless wasteland of anarchist insurrection. It is a peaceful expression of our community's collective grief and their desire to build a better world, she tweeted on June 11, 2020. Durkan, along with Governor Jay Inslee, both Democrats, had gone to great lengths to emphasize the peaceful nature of the occupation. In a CNN interview with Chris Cuomo, Durkan infamously said Chaz could be a summer of love. Of course, when media crews arrived at the gates of Chaz during the day, this might have been believable. In the daylight hours, they would have seen people having barbecues in the street. People would bring their children to make street art. Others walked their dogs. Ben and Jerry's even set up a truck that passed out free ice cream scoops. Left-wing news site Daily Beast published a report by Kelly Weil, headlined, "Local businesses love the domestic terror zone in Seattle, actually." It claimed to authoritatively debunk President Trump's claim that Chaz was run by domestic terrorists by interviewing a few select business owners who were neutral or supportive of the occupation. For sure, there was some support by locals for the occupiers. Chaz's Little Big Burger, a fast food chain, changed its toilet door code to 1312, a dog whistle for Antifa's ACAB slogan. Each number corresponds to a letter in the alphabet. But many others, I would argue the majority, were silenced through fear and intimidation. At night, a whole different side of Chaz emerged when the media crews and outside visitors left. Because there was no agreed-upon leadership in Chaz, which was intentional, those who naturally rose to the top did so through force or intimidation. For example, Seattle area rapper Raz Simone, real name Solomon Simone, patrolled Chaz on some nights with an armed entourage that functioned as a sort of mini-militia. Some in the media dubbed him the warlord of Chaz. Simone, originally from Georgia, has a criminal record stemming from charges related to cruelty to a child and other offences. He became infamous for conducting his patrols while carrying a semi-automatic rifle and sidearm. One livestream video recorded Simone handing another male a semi-automatic rifle from the trunk of a car. Another video recorded him assaulting a cameraman. Simone relished in the media attention, but also rejected the violent depictions of him. "I'm not a terrorist warlord. Quit spreading that false narrative," he tweeted on June 10th, 2020. "The world has never been ready for a strong black man. We have been peaceful and nothing else. If I die, don't let it be in vain." Not everyone in Chaz recognized Simone's police-like presence, but no one was willing to stand up to him and his group. For one, the optics of confronting a black male in a space for black lives would have been problematic. While Chaz was ostensibly created to be an explicitly anti-racist zone, it ended up segregating along racial lines. Most of Chaz's black residents and black visitors did not follow Antifa's anarchist-communist ideology. Some actively took issue with Antifa's destruction and vandalism of the space. The white anarchist, socialist, and communist radicals mostly stayed together in their spaces. As for Simone's disputed leadership, there were severe consequences to those perceived as challengers or threats. Independent Los Angeles-based conservative journalist Kaylin D'Almeida recorded Simone and his armed crew having a meeting shortly after midnight in June. He was spotted filming with his phone by one of Simone's men. That man assaulted him and demanded he turn over his mobile device. When D'Almeida refused, Simone's entourage tried to drag him to the security tent at the taco restaurant.
D'Almeida identified one of his assailants as Duan Young.
Young later became one of Chaz's shooting victims in a different dispute. He was never charged or arrested. He repeated himself several times. You're going to hand over your phone or I'm going to knock you the fuck out and take it from you, D'Almeida said. D'Almeida escaped by hiding in a construction site outside Chaz until police responded to his 911 call. I ran from the autonomous zone and multiple people attempted to drag me back to their interrogation tent for questioning. I saw D'Almeida soon after the assault. His jacket was filthy and he was rattled. He was lucky to make it out of Chaz with only minor scrapes and bruising. Other journalists were also attacked at Chaz. Dan Springer, a reporter with Fox News, was trapped in his car and surrounded by rioters who jumped on the vehicle. On another occasion, he was followed and kicked out of Chaz. As much as Chaz was an experiment in anarchy and chaos, it was also a successful experiment in propaganda making. What journalists were allowed to record was heavily controlled by the residents there. For example, in one instance, a black man carried an American flag through the zone. He was immediately accosted and followed by a large mob, including masked black bloc Antifa, who shouted racist invectives at him. Race traitor! Race traitor! One man yelled repeatedly on a bullhorn. Fox News will use this, another person yelled after rioters tried to steal his flag. This became a relatively common refrain in Chaz any time fights broke out. Chaz supporters were not interested in reality. They wanted the media to broadcast to the world a fabricated utopia. Those unfortunate enough to have homes within Chaz had no say over their new overlords. Residents discreetly voiced their concerns to local media. Some moved out temporarily. There were reports of gunshots and screams of terror at night. On one day I was there, a resident inside an apartment building came out twice to ask protesters to leave the alleyway where the apartment entrance is. They brushed him off. The alley had been severely vandalized with graffiti and extremist messages. It also houses a back entrance to the police east precinct. At night, volunteers guarded the alley after Antifa expressed a desire to break inside the precinct to burn it down. According to the police chief, there were credible threats to burn down the building. It was later reported that she was briefed on intelligence from the FBI. Business owners, however, did not have the luxury of leaving on a whim. Every business and property inside Chaz was vandalized with graffiti. Most messages said some variation of ACAB, Black Lives Matter, or George Floyd. But other messages called for the murder of police. These were the least of their problems, however. Faisal Khan, the owner of Cafe Argento, told the New York Times, "They barricaded us all in here." He didn't dare speak to media until weeks after Chaz's demise. They were sitting in lawn chairs with guns. His testimony to the paper comports with what I witnessed myself. Though there were thousands in Chaz during the day, actual business was incredibly slow. Customer traffic was severely impacted from the street blockades. People could only travel in and out by foot. Chaz residents had no need to purchase food or drink, given that there were more than a dozen free food stations across the zone. Donations from outsiders were dropped off around the clock, and people gifted so many pizza deliveries that Chaz residents began turning down offers of free pizza slices. In the early hours of June 14th, 2020, a hip-hop dance party in the middle of Chaz was disrupted when someone announced that a fellow resident was being held at gunpoint. The man rallied the crowd, and within seconds, everyone ran after him. After several blocks of running,
we arrived at Car Tender, an auto repair shop. Within minutes, the mob rushed the gate of the business, breaking it easily. They threatened to ransack and destroy the business. The rumour of someone being held at gunpoint turned out to be baseless. The business's security had detained Richard Hanks, 21, who allegedly broke inside and was trying to start a fire. Jason Rantz, a Seattle-based conservative radio host and journalist, interviewed the business owners. "The son, Mason, told me they called 911 over a dozen times and they refused to send officers to come pick Hanks, the suspect, up, because SPD was told they couldn't go into the chop zone," Rant says. "Mason told me over 100 people, several armed, showed up outside their business, yelling at them to turn Hanks over or they'd burn the business down. They tore down the fencing around the building and stormed the yard, so Mason and his dad ended up releasing Hanks to the crowd." By miracle, bloodshed was narrowly averted. A large team of CHAZ volunteers successfully de-escalated the explosive situation by forming a human chain. It was the only time I witnessed CHAZ volunteers actually ending imminent conflict. Most of the time, rioters gave in to their base instincts and were uncontrollable. For example, a street preacher was pinned to the ground during one day and forcibly deported. Though mass violence was averted, the night of the break-in at Car Tender, the business's address was put on a list on the Cop Blaster website, which purports to track police brutality and snitches. His shop has been subject to frequent harassment and threats ever since. A private security firm that volunteered to help the business later said they found a cache of weapons, including a semi-automatic rifle and loaded magazines, hidden in a nearby bush. One glaring blind spot in the mainstream media coverage of CHAZ was how the space gave platform to violent extremist ideologies. Reports about CHAZ's political agenda focused shallowly on racial justice and defunding the police, rather than its explicit calls to kill cops and overthrow the government. Hundreds of graffiti messages and images lined the zone, showing dead pigs wearing police hats. "No work, no cops. End this stupid fucking world," read one message. "Voting keeps you tame. All politicians are the same," read another. Around CHAZ, Antifa had also marked their territory. The red and black flag of anarchist communism was painted on several buildings. There were also stickers plastered around for the Anti-Fascist Action Group. I even saw Rose City Antifa member Luis Marquez with his friends at CHAZ. For those who ignored the ubiquitous graffiti, they could also read some of the posters and signs. "COVID-19 is the virus. Capitalism is the pandemic," declared one sign posted around CHAZ. One large handwritten poster stated, "Death to capitalism." It blamed capitalism for racism and poverty. Political groups also moved in to capitalize on the opportunity to recruit new members. The Democratic Socialists of America, DSA, featured prominently via a booth. The DSA has been given a veneer of mainstream respectability with the popular rise of Senator Bernie Sanders and Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, two politicians endorsed by the party. But reading their manifesto makes clear they are traditional socialists with the explicit agenda of abolishing capitalism. Another group that set up in CHAZ was the Seattle Revolutionary Socialists, who share a similar agenda to the DSA, but are more explicit about their regime change ambitions. Tellingly, there was no Democratic Party presence at CHAZ. As leftward as the Democrats have swung in reaction to Trump, the party is still viewed as too moderate for the revolutionaries who want the abolishment of police, capitalism, and the United States itself. They mean it when they chant, "No Trump, no wall, no USA at all. Beyond political parties, extremists set up tables where they distributed extremist agitprop, literature and instruction manuals printed from anarchist think tanks or zine collectives. By the end of the day, they'd all been given out to anyone who walked by, including children and youth. In one booklet titled Blockade, Occupy, Strike Back, instructions are given on how to use human shields against police and how to make rudimentary bombs using light bulbs and paint. A large crowd, especially of ordinary everyday people, is our first line of defense against a police attack, the manual reads. If the police build barricades, the crowd will be between us and the cops rather than outside police lines. As riots continued in Portland and elsewhere in the following months, Antifa militants used these instructions in their riot formations. Additionally, light bulb paint bombs were routinely used to attack police. They primarily serve the purpose of obscuring cops' vision. Those who don't wear riot gear are cut by the shattered glass. Another booklet given out at Chaz was titled Against the Police and the Prison World They Maintain. It features short essays on why police, capitalism, and the state must be destroyed by any means necessary, including through violence. One section explains how the media are enemies used to pacify revolutionaries. Our contempt for the media is inextricable from our hatred of this entire world, the booklet reads. Attacks on journalists who were accused of not toeing the line were commonplace in Chaz, and generally any event organized by the far left. They justify it by claiming self-defense to protect their identities from being unmasked through photos or video footage. Another booklet distributed at the table stood out for its front cover artwork, a stark black and white image of a balaclava with the title Accomplices, Not Allies. The manual lists the problems of having allies, for example, academics and non-profits in the movement who are unwilling to participate in criminal direct action. As Chaz continued into its second week, pleas from those who live and work inside Capitol Hill were ignored by the mayor and city council. Even subtle public jabs from the now former police chief Carmen Best were ignored. Best stated that police response times in the area had more than tripled because the SPD was down a station for a large area of the city. What was previously a 5-minute response time for emergencies was now taking up to 18 minutes. Emergency calls, which often means somebody's being assaulted, sometimes it's a rape, sometimes it's a robbery, but something bad is happening if it's a top priority call and we're not able to get there, she told media at the time. Not only did the city of Seattle refuse to restore order, they actually provided periodic upgrades to Chaz. On June 16, 2020, the city brought in concrete street blockades that also doubled as graffiti canvases. The city maintained cleaning services, wash stations, and portable toilets for the occupiers. Despite claiming to be an autonomous zone, Chaz was a welfare state parasitizing off Seattle taxpayers. A few days after Chaz's establishment, an arsonist attempted to make good on the threat to burn down the East Precinct. On June 12, 2020, a person was recorded on CCTV pouring an accelerant on debris on the side of the precinct and setting it on fire. Others in the area ran in and quickly put out the flames using extinguishers. They could be heard on video telling someone to move the gas can. 35-year-old Isaiah Willoughby was later arrested and charged by federal authorities following an investigation by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms and Explosives, ATF. Willoughby had run for Seattle City Council in 2018. The early signs of violence continued. On June 20th, 2020, live-streamed video captured the sound of multiple gunshots inside Chaz. Video showed a frantic response, with people sprinting around and yelling about a shooting. Horace Lorenzo Anderson Jr., a 19-year-old black male, was treated by street medics at the scene and transported to Harborview Medical Center. He later died. Anderson's older brother told live streamers he was prevented by street medics from seeing his dying brother, who they were treating inside their tent at the Mexican restaurant. "They hid my little brother from me for the longest. I thought my little brother was at a hospital," the unnamed brother told cameramen at Chaz. "I didn't see where they had my little brother at until about 9 o'clock this morning. The table was covered in blood." SPD released a statement saying that the city's medics were unable to respond because of a violent and hostile mob. Officers attempted to locate a shooting victim, but were met by a violent crowd that prevented officers' safe access to the victims, they wrote. Horace Lorenzo Anderson Sr., the deceased victim's father, said the family had been left in the dark with little contact from police and no contact from Seattle politicians. He shared his grief in an interview with Fox News's Sean Hannity. "My son needed help, and I don't feel like they helped my son," he said, referring to Chaz's volunteer street medics. He later received a phone call from President Trump, who expressed his condolences. The gun violence didn't end that night. The following day, a third black male was shot. An unnamed 17-year-old was transported to hospital and survived. Per Chaz's rule of not talking with the pigs, the teen declined to cooperate with SPD in the shooting investigation. And just 2 days later, on June 23rd, another black male was shot. He survived, but also refused to speak with police. Despite the three shootings that left one man dead, the city continued to tolerate Chaz's lawlessness. Meanwhile, Mayor Durkan proposed a $20 million cut to the SPD budget. There was no singular vision or goal in Chaz. The occupation was made up of several far-left ideological factions: anarchists, communists, anarcho-syndicalists, Marxist black nationalists, and so on. One manifesto, posted on blog site Medium, demanded the abolishment of the criminal justice system. "The Seattle Police Department and attached court system are beyond reform," the statement read. "We do not request reform. We demand abolition." Jaden Grayson, a young black woman who developed a large following in Chaz, told filmmaker Amy Horowitz, "Respond to the demands of the people or prepare to be met with any means necessary. It's not even a warning. I'm letting people know what comes next." She did not elaborate further, but what came next was more deadly violence. As the city cowered in the face of extremists in Chaz, a fourth shooting broke out. In the early hours of June 29, 2020, a white Jeep driven by two young teens made the fatal mistake of going inside the autonomous zone. What exactly happened remains unclear because witnesses refused to cooperate with law enforcement, but security video recorded the sound of a dozen shots being rapidly fired. After a few minutes of silence, another 18 rounds were fired. The Jeep ended up crashing into a barricade. What we know is that a 16-year-old black male was taken from the scene to hospital, where he was pronounced dead. A 14-year-old passenger sustained serious injuries but survived. Photos and videos of the aftermath showed grisly details. The vehicle was riddled with bullet holes, allegedly fired by Chaz's security. One round was fired clean through the windshield on the driver's side. This is likely the shot that killed the teen driver. Inside, the seats were soaked with blood. When police responded to the crime scene, They found signs of evidence were missing, removed, and tampered with. No one was willing to speak. One video recorded moments after the shooting showed a group of Chaz residents picking up bullet shells and instructing others to do the same. "Once you see any shells on the ground, pick those up and pocket them. Take them home," said one man. Online, a clearer picture emerged through posts by Antifa sympathetic accounts, including possibly from those inside Chaz. Before the identities of the victims were known, online Antifa sympathetic accounts claimed Chaz security had neutralized a threat from white supremacists. "Two guys in a stolen SUV shot up hashtag chop tonight," tweeted user @MaliceBD. "They came through and fired 15 shots, then maybe 15 minutes later drove across Cal Anderson Field and opened fire again, and got fucking murdered, by security on the ground. This is the SUV they were driving. Beautiful shot placement." To date, no video or evidence shows shots originating from inside the vehicle. @MaliceBD continued, "I know I shouldn't glorify death and violence, but TBH, to be honest, if you try and shoot at innocent people, then you deserve to get fucking dealt with." Those responding to the viral tweets thanked Chaz security for protecting the residents there. "Congratulations! I'm proud of you anarchists. Makes us MLs, Marxist-Leninists, look like old men proud of their sons or grandsons. Keep up to sick good work," tweeted @JaredComrade. It later emerged that the victims of the shooting were two unarmed black males. Marty Jackson, a street medic, told an NPR affiliate that Chaz security shot at the vehicle and that one of the victims was instantly killed from a headshot wound. Despite claiming to be a refuge for blacks from white racists, Chaz ended up with a 100% black victim shooting rate. To date, only one suspect was named in all the shootings. A warrant was issued by the SPD for the arrest of Marcel Levon Long, who is accused of murdering the first shooting victim, Horace Lorenzo Anderson Jr. After four shootings, two homicides, and a growing chorus of anger from residents in the form of a class action lawsuit, Mayor Durkan finally relented and issued an executive order to forcibly dismantle Chaz. On the morning of July 1st, 2020, around 100 SPD officers joined by other law enforcement agencies moved in quickly on foot and bicycles to evict the remaining occupiers. Rioters attempted to obstruct police by moving junk into the street and knocking over porta-potties. It was futile. Within 30 minutes, Chaz's three-week siege was finally over. All it took was a police force given the directive to do their jobs effectively. Though Chaz had died, its ghost lived on. In the weeks after the zone was forcibly dismantled, Antifa Black Bloc rioters returned weekly to Capitol Hill to vandalize property, break into businesses, and attack police. On July 23, 2020, a large group of Antifa marched around the neighborhood carrying bats and pipes. After smashing several businesses, they started fires. Journalists who recorded the carnage were threatened. Police were ordered away and no arrests were made. Despite the violence during and after Chaz, Seattle's city council remained sympathetic to Antifa. They never condemned the violence against police officers and police buildings. "The energy behind these demonstrations and riots was something I've never experienced. I was shocked," said Mike Solon, president of the Seattle Police Officers Guild, SPOG, the Union for Seattle Police Officers. He's been in law enforcement for 21 years, but says the riots led to the lowest point in his profession and, in his opinion, all those serving in the department. The SPD used to pride itself on being one of the most progressive and well-trained police departments in the United States on non-lethal use of force. Since 2000, The department averages fewer than 4 police-involved fatal shootings a year. The city has a population of over 700,000 people. But now, the SPD was tarred with the same brush applied to all law enforcement. Almost 100 SPD officers have been hurt in these riots. Not one politician elected in Seattle has approached me to inquire how those officers are doing, Solon said. Most of the injuries to SPD officers by rioters are lacerations and burns. But there have also been broken bones, nerve damage, and hearing loss. These IEDs are the weapons of choice, and their impact has played a significant role in the officers' hearing issues, Solon explained. These physical injuries will last a long time, and some will be permanent. But more importantly is the mental toll on officers. He noted that some officers are showing symptoms of PTSD. 2 days after the Antifa riot on July 23, 2020, Antifa again gathered in Capitol Hill. This time, it was in solidarity with their militant brethren in Portland, who had been rioting for weeks by this point. Carrying bats and sledgehammers, they smashed up cars and other property. They marched around the city in broad daylight and firebombed several construction trailers, causing large fires. A Starbucks was smashed, looted, and severely damaged. Police finally declared a riot, but when officers responded, Antifa threw explosive fireworks at them. The East Precinct was also targeted again. Antifa militants threw a bomb at the building, causing explosion and structural damage. By the end of the day, 59 officers were injured. They were not allowed to use tear gas to disperse the violent rioters. Photos released by SPD of the injuries showed gashes, burns, and welts. One officer even had an explosive mortar burn through his shorts. And again, the violence didn't end there. It continued week after week. On August 16th, 2020, Antifa Black Bloc marched to the Seattle Police Officer Guild building. They tried to break inside, using an explosive. Officers responding to the riot were pelted with rocks, bottles, and IEDs. 18 were arrested, and multiple officers were injured, including one who required hospitalization. But Antifa promised to continue their rampage, which they now referred to as an uprising. On August 24th, 2020, they amassed outside the East Precinct again. Some rioters climbed over the fence, protecting the building, and sealed an exit with suspected quick-drying cement. They then set the side of the building on fire. Officers were inside the building during this time. The brazen attempt to kill officers inside their own precinct using a barricade and fire garnered the attention of ATF. I asked Mike Solon why police appear to be letting rioters return week after week, and sometimes day after day, to attack the same area. His response was blunt. Our commanders are now hesitant to engage with some of these groups roaming around the city. If we do use force to stop the impending property destruction, SPD will not have the support from our politicians to publicly back us. At an Antifa riot on September 23, 2020, in Capitol Hill, a masked militant bashed an officer on the head with a metal baseball bat. The officer's helmet was cracked from the impact, and he barely escaped the assault. A 19-year-old related to a former Democratic state lawmaker was later arrested and charged with multiple felonies. His accused accomplice is a Seattle area real estate agent. The King County charging documents say investigators uncovered encrypted communications between the two on a mobile device. The chat showed them allegedly planning to firebomb Seattle police. Though Chaz or Chop was relatively short-lived, I'm still haunted by my experience there. The autonomous zone provided some of the clearest glimpses into what an Antifa-run territory becomes full of: chaos, violence, and death. The entirety of Chop's existence is the craziest part of the story when you think about it, Rance, the radio host and journalist, says. The city of Seattle literally abandons 6 city blocks, a park, all the businesses and residents inside, and even a police precinct. If you were in the occupied zone, you were completely on your own. Indeed, I was on my own. And Antifa eventually found out. I would have stayed longer than the week I was there, but on my last afternoon, I was outed. And by whom? None other than Nicholas Armstrong, the transsexual Antifa militant who had previously stalked and threatened me online. Though I was in full black block, she recognized me after analyzing my movement for days. While I was recording an altercation, Armstrong pointed me out to a group that had gathered. "That's Andy No! He's a fascist!" she shouted. My blood ran cold. Though I was in front of the East Precinct, it was abandoned, and I knew no authorities would be able to help here. I immediately walked out of Chaz and rushed to the lift car I ordered. To this day, I still find myself underestimating how committed and sophisticated Antifa are to their political agenda of destroying opponents and the state. They're obsessive and compulsive, and they will use any means available to achieve their goals. That includes doxing, disinformation, or straight-up thuggish violence. The terror they subjected Seattle residents to had long-lasting consequences beyond Chaz. By August 2020, the SPD police chief announced she was resigning. Carmen Best had served as an officer in the city since 1992 and became Seattle's first black female police chief. But as she said in one of her final press conferences, "I'm done. Can't do it." The day prior, City Council voted to cut SPD's budget, including eliminating 100 positions. As I left Seattle, I mourned for the law-abiding people who had been terrorized into silence. They were completely failed by their elected leaders. And despite the organized violence playing out in the open, the media headlines still denied the existence of Antifa. "How much more violence and chaos by Antifa are politicians willing to accept?" I asked myself while on the train out of the city. Unfortunately, a whole lot more.